Actually, could we get the other light too? Do we need that light? Yeah. So, in today's presentation, I'm interested in how transnationalism. Thank you. This is the concept of migrants having a place in two worlds, right? The sending country where they're from, and then the receiving country. How that matters in the lives of the second generation. And when I say second generation, I mean the U.S.-born children of immigrants, or if they were born in another country, they came to the U.S. by the age of 12. So largely went to school in the U.S., okay? And I look at the experiences of second-generation Dominican and Chinese adults, who grew up in strong transnational fields and had parents who wanted them to be a part of the homeland imaginary. So immigrants, they tend to view the country that they've moved to as their home, and we know that their children certainly do that, right? But still, it's important to understand how the old country has meaning in their lives. And this is particularly important given the increasingly globalized world in which we live. Okay, so this is where I do my own pub, Russell. So the data that I'll discuss in today's presentation have been presented in a few outlets, including the journal Identities, and you can see the article from which this presentation draws. And also, my most recent book, which is available online, Keeping the Immigrant Bargain, which looks at the transition to college and identities among the children of Dominican and Colombian immigrant families through interviews with both the adult children and their immigrant parents. Okay. And then also, it draws from the work in my first book, Compelled to Excel, which looks at the transition to college and identities among the children of Chinese immigrants. And this was published by Stanford Press, my most recent book by the Russell Sage Foundation. But they're both available online. Okay. So I always like to start off with why this is an important story to tell, right? Why you actually came out here on a Friday night in the cold to sit down and listen to me. And this is, of course, a story about immigration. So we're all in New York City right now. I don't have to tell you how important immigration is, but it is part of my job. So the United States is in the midst of a large-scale immigration that began after the Immigration Act of 1965. And today, nearly 40 million Americans, that's close to 13%, are foreign-born. And this slide gives you a sense of how immigrant children are really a significant and growing proportion of our youth. So the concept of transnationalism challenges the long-held idea that when immigrants leave their country, they leave it behind, right? And they migrate and settled in the new country. Instead, transnationalism asks us to think about immigrants maintaining strong ties to their home countries and how those ties link to their new lives in another country. So studies of immigrant transnationalism, meaning the first generation, folks who actually come as adults, those studies have shown that there are four major themes, okay? Those studies, one of those themes is how migrants are citizens of nation states. The kinds of regional and political attachments that they hold in two countries. The more recent efforts of nation states to reclaim their allegiance, to have them vote in their home countries, to have them come back and participate in political campaigns, right? Some politicians, for example, from the Dominican Republic, they actually come to New York City to campaign for votes, hoping that migrants here will vote for them through transnational ties. We also look at the role of transnational markets and capital, so the development of ethnic communities. And then third has been this really intense circular flow of migrants and their children that transportation and technology advances have really helped make easier. And then finally, we're also paying a lot of attention to the national and individual identities of folks who are in these kind of transnational social fields. And the other thing that I want to note is that even though transnationalism took place in earlier periods of American history, because again, the United States, we have a very, very long history of migration, in the contemporary era, we find that it's happening a lot more regularly because of technology and kind of the spread of globalization. All right, so the Dominicans. So there have been quite a number of studies about Dominican immigrants in the U.S., and what it's shown us is how there can be advantages that come with being transnational. So Dominican migrants have become major players in the Dominican economy, in their home country. They send money back, a lot of money back. They buy things when they go back to the DR, the Dominican Republic. They help to start businesses there, all right? They vote, as I've just said. And then also, they compare themselves to Dominicans back in the home country, to working class and poor Dominicans back there. And what I mean by that is that in the United States, Dominican migrants can purchase consumer goods like a color TV that in the DR would mark them as having a middle class status. Okay? But in the United States, of course, even though they can buy a color TV, the Dominicans have a working class and poor status on average in the jobs that they work, where they live. But being able to compare themselves to folks in the DR help these working class and poor Dominican immigrants in the U.S. feel that they have some sort of middle class identity. Okay. Peggy Levitt has done a lot of important work on how migrants in their traveling back and forth, and also now today through Skyping. I have to confess, I just Skyped for the first time last month. So I'm kind of, I know, kind of a dinosaur. It worked out really well. It took me, you know, a while. But anyway, so, but through technology and also going back and forth, right, migrants are able to bring back values and practices that they've been exposed to, in this case, in the U.S. Okay. Another line of inquiry that Peggy Levitt, she's a sociologist at Wellesley College, pioneered, looked at how, if at all, transnationalism actually happens in the lives of the second generation. Again, these are folks who are born in the United States, or they came at an early enough age to be raised and educated here. And why this question is important, you know, it's easier to have these kinds of attachments if you're bilingual, right? If you know the language of your home country or your parents' home country. But we know that second-generation folks, we can't assume that they're going to be bilingual. And we also know that the family and ethnic communities are really important to this process. So for the migrants themselves, you know, they bring with them these kinds of rituals and objects that they just put in their homes, right? And these rituals and objects have meaning of their past lives, even though they're now in the U.S. But the children of immigrants undergo this process of home building through their parents. So I just want to give an example. My parents are actually in the audience tonight. I'm not going to out them, but but they came out from Queens. And so basically when I was growing up, actually in New York City, I was born in Manhattan's Chinatown and grew up in Queens. And ancestor worship was a really big deal in our home, right? We would go to the cemetery. We would burn incense at home. But typically, I didn't really understand what those things meant till I was older and could ask them questions, or I would read about it in my own research. I would take out books to learn about what we were actually doing in the home. So, also in the United States, we have racial identities, we have ethnic identities, we have class identities, and we have inequalities along all of those lines. And all of those things can influence what transnational attachments mean to people. So the fact that someone is racialized as Asian American or Latino can shape whether you want to be transnational and also how you see being transnational. So the Dominican and Chinese comparison is interesting for a lot of other reasons. For one thing, the Immigration Act of 1965 has given a rise to urban ethnic communities in the Northeast for both these groups that represent strong transnational fields. But the different communities have been shaped by different social forces. So in the Chinese case, the new immigration has given life to what had been a declining Chinatown in New York City. Again, I won't call out my parents, but if you ask them, they would say, as well as my uncle and his lovely sister, they're also in the audience, I won't call them out either. But if you ask them, because they were old timers in Chinatown before 1965, when there was only one Chinatown in New York City, which is in Manhattan. And if you would ask them back in the day, well, what do you think is going to be the future of Chinatown? They probably would have told you it's going to die out, right? Because it's the 1960s. Now with the civil rights movement, we can move out to places like Queens, right, or Brooklyn or other areas. We don't have to just live in Chinatown. Before, there were very few options to do that. But what the new immigration has done post-1965, it's brought all these new immigrants in who are Chinese, from Taiwan, Hong Kong, other nation states, they've formed new Chinatowns in Brooklyn and in Queens, in Flushing. What's also happened, and we know this from the work of Peter Kwong, of course, distinguished professor at Hunter College, is that now you have Chinese people coming from very many different social classes into New York City. You have the downtown Chinese who don't have a lot of skills, may not speak English, but you also have the uptown Chinese who go straight to the suburbs, right? Bayside, Queens, for example. Who have a lot of resources and they speak a lot of English, okay? In the Dominican case, we know that they've had a lot of rich transnational networks culturally, politically, economically. Migrants here invest very strongly in the DR, in the economy. But one important thing to note is that in contrast to the Chinese case, the flow of wealth amongst Dominicans has not been bidirectional. And by that I mean, for example, that Washington Heights in New York City, Upper Manhattan, which for many decades was a very strong Dominican immigrant community, it didn't have the kinds of substantial transnational investments that the Chinatowns could get from investors in Asia, for example, right? So mainly it was Dominican migrants sending money home to the DR, not Dominican investors coming to New York City to build businesses here. And then finally, the Dominican and Chinese comparison is interesting because they belong to ethnic, pan-ethnic groups, meaning Latinos and Asians, that have really been framed very differently in the United States, right? Latinos, they've been typified as underachievers. That's how they're framed. I'm not saying that's how they are. And according to that framing, they're likely to turn to crime, have too many kids, go on welfare, fail in schools, not do well in life. Again, that's the framing. The framing of Asian Americans has been very different. They're framed as overachievers. They're likely to emphasize education, to sacrifice for later goals, to do well in school, to climb that mobility ladder. Again, that's the framing. I'm not saying that that's the way it is. Okay, so how I did this work, where the data actually come from, I conducted interviews with 39 Dominicans and 40 Chinese Americans, all who had some college. I did a survey to collect basic demographic data, such as where they were born, their parents' country of birth, region of origin, how much education they had, what schools they went to, their language use. The interviews were nearly all conducted in person, tape recorded, and transcribed. In the Chinese sample, this was, I have to say, very many years ago, when I was a doctoral student living in New York City, I recruited participants at Hunter, where I'm now presently based, the CUNY Public Commuter College, and I also recruited participants at Columbia, the Ivy League University, of course, which is further uptown. And the Dominican sample is part of a larger project on the transition to college and identities among second-generation Dominicans and Colombians that included a subset of their immigrant parents. In the Dominican sample, I recruited folks who came from a wide range of colleges and universities. I'm not going to get into that so much right now, but if you want to, you can certainly ask me why that was the case. Okay. So nearly half of the Dominicans grew up mainly in Dominican enclaves, such as New York City's Washington Heights back in the day, Jamaica Plain in Boston back in the day, for those of you who are from Boston, Lawrence in Greater Boston. About half had one or more parents working in low-level jobs, in sales, factories, amongst mothers doing secretarial work. What you can see here is about 62% of the Chinese lived in the Chinese enclaves of New York City or neighborhoods like Elmhurst and Queens that had a lot of Chinese immigrants. About 74% had parents who were involved with the Chinese enclave economy, mainly in the restaurant business, labor-intensive jobs, or with the garment industry. Okay. I want to point out that this was a small, non-random sample. I have to say this, I'm a sociologist by training, because I used, of course, in-depth qualitative research as my approach. So we can't generalize from these findings to the general Dominican and Chinese populations in the United States who are second generation. However, that said, you know, the kind of research approach that I use, meaning these interviews, really are helpful because they help us understand how things happen. So how these attachments come to be and how they have meaning. All right. So two things struck me about Chinese home life when I spoke to the folks. Okay. The people I interviewed, they described the Chinese family as having strong parent-child ties. But these family ties were not expressed in emotional closeness, in what the mainstream American culture would talk about as being close, right? So Victor described his parents as being typical. He said they just weren't very talkative. It's just like that with Chinese families, he told me. Very quiet, a lot of unspoken words. According to the folks I interviewed, the only times that their parents really talked to them was when their parents wanted them to do something, right? This kind of communication between the parents and children in the Chinese immigrant families wasn't helped by the fact that the Chinese second generation were rapidly losing their Chinese language skills. We know that this is actually the case from large-scale survey data in the United States, that Asians, on average, who are immigrants, that Asian languages are being lost very, very quickly, okay, over time. So consistent with that, close to 60% of the Chinese whom I interviewed said that they were only functional speakers and listeners of Chinese. Fluency was low, and patterns of language shift occurred even though their Chinese parents wanted them to learn Chinese and would send them to the Chinese language schools in New York City. I don't know how many of you have been to them. I never have, actually, but my brothers went, and they can safely attest to the fact that they didn't learn much Chinese. So, but anyway, it's a good cause, right? So the fact that they weren't fluent in Chinese, the kids meaning, Well, that's going to be a huge issue when they try to communicate with their parents, right? So Kathy described herself as a functional Chinese speaker, but she talked about how frustrated she was with her parents' disapproval of her life choices, and how she just couldn't get her point across to her parents. So she says, like with my mother, I cannot express myself in Cantonese. I just don't have that vocabulary. And in English, she will have a hard time to understand me. So what emerged instead were these distinct generationally bound spaces in the home. So let me break that out for you. What I mean is that the children disengaged, were not engaged with the ethnic holidays that their parents observed in the home, right? So the folks that I spoke with felt compelled to perform the rituals, but they rarely knew what the holidays were called, why the holidays were being celebrated, and what exactly they were doing to celebrate them. And in fact, I often found myself in the course of the interviews with the Chinese telling them what they didn't know, right? So one young woman asked me, you know, I don't get the fact that on Chinese New Year, you're not supposed to wash your hair, right? My mom makes such a big deal about this. What's up with that? So I said, you know, what's up with that is that, according to traditional Chinese traditions, at least in some families, including yours and mine, that means you wash away your good luck on Chinese New Year, right? And so then you won't have good luck for the whole following year. She was very happy to know. They also didn't know the names, whether in Chinese or in English, of the objects that their parents were using in these rituals. And of course, these objects themselves were sold in the various Chinatowns, sold through transnational markets, right? They were made in Asia and then imported into the U.S. and sold in the enclaves. Instead, the holidays that their parents celebrated became markers of Chinese food and foreignness. So this is how Peggy identified the generational gap in the cultural practices of Chinese Americans and those of immigrant adults like her parents. She said, Chinese Americans, I guess they can identify more to reality, whereas I think the traditional Chinese deals a lot with superstitions. There's like an explanation behind superstitions, meaning of her generation, as opposed to just believing superstitions. Because the parents and the children didn't talk a lot in these families, and because the second generation didn't have a lot of Chinese language skills, what it meant was that the Chinese whom I interviewed, they didn't really know a lot about where their parents had come from in Asia, right? In most cases, China and Hong Kong. They didn't know a lot about the specifics of their own family histories. In a few cases, they didn't even know where their parents were born. In others, they didn't know the details of when and how their parents came to make the journey to America. But they said that in those few times when the parents did share stories of the home country, their parents' goal was to make sure their children were behaving well, right? So what they did was, as in this case, Grace talks about her parents' use of the homeland to police Grace's behavior in the U.S. So she said, hanging out at night. They think when we're watching those Chinese movies, they think we're bad that we're doing all these drugs. They'll think we're bad little slutty girls running around. I think it's fine. It's nothing. It's normal. But they think otherwise. So what happened was when they went to college, and remember, I sampled on folks who had gone to college. So when they went to college, the Chinese folks that I interviewed found that it was a great opportunity to fill in the gaps in their knowledge. They were hungry to know about their identities, their family histories. They wanted to know something. So what they did was they took classes in Chinese languages, in Asian American studies, in East Asian languages and civilizations, right? And the reasons why they took these classes could be instrumental, practical reasons. It fit a time slot, for example. But in many of the cases, they found themselves really learning a lot about who they were through these classes in college. So one of the ironic things that I want to point out is that in college, most colleges and universities, they don't offer Cantonese as a Chinese language class, right? In fact, a lot of people are saying these days, including my own family, that Cantonese is dying out as a language because now the language of the mainland China is Mandarin. And so Mandarin is actually typically the only Chinese language that's offered in college. And so they're taking Chinese classes, but they're learning a language that their parents do not even speak. Okay. So Peggy, her family was Cantonese speaking, and she thought if she studied Mandarin, somehow that very act of doing it would bring her closer to her parents. So she said, "I thought that Mandarin would bring me closer to knowing a Chinese dialect. Like somehow if I started learning Mandarin, that would bring me closer to learning Cantonese, and that would bring me closer to communicating with my parents." So just as the family really kind of transmitted to their children what the homeland meant or what homeland cultures were, but there wasn't a lot of that going on, the Chinese also didn't visit their parents' home countries a lot. Nearly three quarters of them said they either had never been to their parents' home country or had visited only once, and usually at really young ages, and so they didn't have much memory of it at all. Now, of course, this is reflective of the fact that they come from working class backgrounds, right? So these are not children whose families are the transnational Chinese elites that some of you may have read about, who, you know, can send their kids to America to live and be parachute kids, or they're living in America together and they have a lot of money to go back and forth from Asia to New York City. This is not what's happening. And they said, the Chinese folks whom I talked to, that when they did go back to the parents' home country, which was sometimes often also where they were born, they saw the country through the lens, through the eyes of a tourist, right? This was not something that was familiar to them. This was not like, I step on the soil and this is it, this is home for me, right? Somehow they feel like foreigners when they visit Asia. Instead, what the Chinese talked about was how they felt a really strong Chinese ethnic identity in the U.S. And that identity had to do with growing up second generation in these kind of transnational social fields in the Chinatowns. But they also felt that they had this kind of openness that they gained from having grown up in the U.S. So I think it's important to understand when the Chinese second generation talked about themselves as being Chinese, right? They almost all identified as being Chinese. They're not talking about the cultural practices of their immigrant parents. They're not talking about young adults who are their age, who have recently arrived from Asia. And they're not talking about youth in Asia who are their same ages, okay? So I don't know if any of you had the chance to attend Professor Fang Xi, Irene Yang's lecture here at ARI. It was really great. On November 15th, I was here, actually. And in which she talked about the production and consumption of inter-Asian love dramas in Taiwan. Okay? So the Chinese folks that whom I interviewed might watch those kinds of Asian soap operas, but they don't understand them in the same ways that Asian youth in Asia would. Okay, I think that's really important to understand. They also saw themselves as being more exposed to American culture. That was also a part of who they were. So they enjoyed being part of the vibrant cultures of Chinatown, but they also enjoyed the vibrant racial and ethnic diversity at Hunter College. So Grace, she was born and raised in the United States. She says that gives her a particular take on her identity. So she says, like, I love it when I come to Hunter because I was away from the whole Chinese thing. Because America is like what we see on TV. It's not only Asians, it's blacks, Spanish people. I really enjoy being in a mixed atmosphere. But having grown up in the United States, the Chinese whom I spoke with also had to negotiate some identities that were imposed on them. Identity is never just about what you want to be. It's also about what other people want you to be. It's always a two-way street. So they found that they had to negotiate these larger mainstream ideas of Asian Americans as model minorities. And by that I mean being high achievers and wealthy. So Julia was the daughter of a retired chef and garment worker. She still lived with them, her parents, in a Chinatown tenement apartment. And she saw the mismatch between this image of Asian Americans as being super wealthy, so smart, everything, and her own family circumstances. And she said that there's a tension, mainly in the model minority image, how it's used to divide minority groups, with Asians held up as being the group that supposedly made it in America versus underachieving blacks and Latinos. So she said, I encountered one of my friend's mother who assumed that I was rich. So my friend asked me, are you rich? And I'm like, no, I mean, I'm just as poor as you are. She lived in Harlem. She's African American. And I lived in Chinatown. And I was laughing so hard. Like, you can't be serious, you know. Other images that they talked about were actually the non-images of Asian men because they're absent in American media. And also the framing of Asian American women as exotic and submissive when they're actually in the media at all. Okay. So now I want to switch over to the Dominicans. We have a clear sense now of what it's been like for the Chinese. What was the experience like for second generation Dominicans? And here what you can see is that parent-child relationship was also hugely important to them. But in contrast, they had a different kind of relationship with their parents that made it easier for them to be part of their parents' homeland imaginaries. And part of this was the open lines of communication in the Dominican families, right? The ease that they felt talking to their parents, and certainly talking to their parents about the DR. Okay? Now, the role of language is really important to highlight here. The Dominicans whom I spoke with, they talked about the relative ease of speaking with their parents because they themselves knew Spanish. Again, consistent with what we know from large-scale national survey data, Spanish speakers actually retain Spanish to a larger extent than Asians retain their Asian languages. So 77% of the Dominicans said that they fluently spoke and understood Spanish. More than half said they were fluent in reading and writing Spanish. And another 39% said they were functional. And what's really interesting is they didn't go to Spanish language schools, right? This was something that actually occurred within the home. Unlike the Chinese, who really felt like outsiders to the traditions that their parents celebrated in the home, the Dominicans felt they were very much a part of the traditions in the home that their immigrant parents were putting into place. So one young man said about Dominican culture, we just lived it. The picture painted by the Dominicans I spoke with was one where immigrant parents, extended kinfolk, and the larger ethnic community actively transmitted Dominican culture. Whether it had to do with the importance of the Virgin Mary, right? These are almost nearly all Catholics. Whether it had to do with the Dominican Republic's national anthem, holidays, everyday poems, nursery songs, food. I mean, it was incredibly rich to look at this data from a comparative perspective. Their parents routinely took out Spanish language books from the library to read to their young children. As the children grew older, they themselves went to the library to take out Spanish language books for themselves. They shared books within the family that were in Spanish. So what that meant is there was little sense of an immigrant space and a second generation space. Instead, there's a shared space for both. And it was through these kinds of ties and relationships that the Dominicans whom I spoke with, they had more extensive knowledge of the family and homeland histories. And I could see this contrast in the simple fact that Dominicans often could name the specific town that their parents were from in the DR. Not just the general region that their parents came from in the DR, but the specific name of the town, right? This is in contrast to the Chinese. Many of the Dominicans could easily talk about multiple things about the DR. The skin color hierarchy in the DR, a family town where many of the folks were believed to be descended from North American settlers, how difficult it was to live under the Trujillo dictatorship, the lives of their grandparents as farmers, chauffeurs to politically connected employers, tailors. They could talk about the chain migration of their kinfolk to the United States. It was, as one person said, the hand-me-down stuff, markers of the past in the DR, what to avoid, what to remember, that you just tell your kids. In other words, it was the marker of the back there in the here and the now. Like the Chinese, the Dominicans also talked about their parents, though, framing stories of life in the DR as a way to encourage their kids to do better in the United States. So their parents shared with the kids the violence, the lack of running water and electricity in the DR, and how that was used to remind the children of the opportunities they had in the U.S. And like the Chinese, the Dominicans I spoke with also learned about the Dominican Republic, the home country, through the classes they took in college. The key difference was that for the Dominicans, the knowledge they gained from taking these classes was additive. They already knew so much about the Dominican Republic, right? So it was just adding to the knowledge they already had. So Tomas, he said, you know, when I found out the American government kept the dictator Trujillo in power, and then that they always had that influence, that economic influence, and that political influence in Latin America, you know, that's why the country's never had a chance to develop, you know? Because these American guys, they sit in these rooms and they plan people's lives. They play little war games. And they don't allow these countries to fully develop because they exploit their resources. So the fluidity of the back there in the here and now, I could also see that in the high number of trips that folks took to the Dominican Republic. It wasn't limited, this back and forth movement, to folks who had more money, as was the case with the Chinese. Now, of course, the DR is a lot closer to the United States than Asia is, so we have to point that out too. The families of the Dominicans were engaged in these movements, and so what happened was that the family home, the ethnic community in the United States, in New York City and in Greater Boston, and life in the Dominican Republic all became these complementary worlds through which they moved, sometimes seamlessly. They talked about the trips that they took to the DR to get the culture, to escape from Boston in the winter. If you think it's cold now in New York City, you should go to Boston, where I lived for quite a long time. This is nothing. So for the Dominicans, the sense of belonging that they felt in the home country made the possibility of living there a very real one. And some of them had actually left the United States as young kids to go live in the DR for a year or two, right? But very few of the folks whom I interviewed thought that they would end up living or settling in the Dominican Republic because they felt that they had much better economic opportunities in the United States. I also saw how a dual frame of reference based in the DR and in the United States was critical to how the Dominicans understood their racial inequality. So on the one hand, they talked about conceptions of blackness and inequality in the DR as shaped by the country's very contentious relationship with Haiti. The Dominican Republic and Haiti actually coexist on the same island of Hispaniola, but they have very fraught relationships. And the folks whom I interviewed also understood blackness as being very stigmatized in the DR, but still part of these wider racial categories there. So they didn't talk about whiteness. They talked about lightness, being light. But the Dominicans also talked about how blackness and inequality in the United States are framed in a very different way. In the U.S., it's been a black-white binary for much of its history, meaning either you're black or you're white. And it was in this space that the Dominican second generation did their identity work, literally in between two countries. So Lourdes, who talked about race as being the most important thing in the Dominican community, remember talking about this in her college sociology class on Latinos in the U.S. She said, and my professor was like, well, you know, there's not that many white Dominicans. And I'm like, hello, you know, I'm a white Dominican. But then, like, I know a lot of Puerto Ricans, and some will say, are you Puerto Rican? And I'm like, no. So all they see are Dominicans who are dark-skinned or, you know, not as light as me. They also used a dual frame of reference to understand gender relationships. So they talked about mainstream American images of Latino men, just turn on the TV set, as being macho, violent. Latinas, the women, hypersexual, what one young woman called little Lolitas, or just the nameless, faceless women who clean hotel rooms. But because the Dominicans had transnational orientations, they also talked about additional gendered images that they encountered through their back and forth movements between the DR and the United States. The women in particular talked about this. They spoke of the expectations that Dominican men in the United States had for women, as grounded in gendered images of Dominican women back in the DR. So one young woman talked about a young man here in the U.S., a classmate of hers, who could not understand why she and other Dominican women were in college, since they were all going to be pregnant. Some women complained of the transnational movements, I don't know, maintaining other rather unattractive attitudes, like the social acceptance of infidelity on the part of men, right? If it's accepted in the DR, it'll be accepted in America. Just as the Chinese also had to negotiate these stereotypes of Asian Americans as academic achievers, the Dominicans I interviewed talked about the stereotypes of Latinos in the United States and how that's a stigmatized identity, right? That they're underachievers. So Mary said, there's a problem in the U.S. in that Hispanics are portrayed constantly as the lower class, are uneducated, or that they're challenged. And there are a lot of Hispanics not challenged, not poor, and that are very educated. Other folks talked about the association of Latinos and Dominicans in particular with crime, violence, the drug trade. And they talked about how these external images, they had to negotiate these external images in their own lives, which is similar, of course, to what the Chinese talked about as well. Different images, but similar processes. So just to kind of sum up, both Dominican and the Chinese families, they really tried to include their children in a strong homeland imaginary. And by that I mean they tried to recreate homeland cultural practices in the homes in which they lived in the United States. That said, there are key differences due to the kinds of practices that families had and because of how their families were incorporated into their respective transnational fields. So what this meant is that the Chinese second generation, they feel themselves to be occupying a separate second generation space, both in the home life that their immigrant parents create and in the Chinatowns in which they interact. The Dominican folks, they talked about the strong sense of belonging that they feel both in the DR and in America, and how they use a dual frame of reference to understand who they are in America. So where we can go further in future research, it's important to examine the class character of transnationalism in ethnic communities. Who's more likely to be transnational? Why? And in what ways? And then what are the implications for the second generation, the children of immigrants, who live in these transnational spaces? And we also need to pay attention to the shape and the content of family, community, and child relationships around homeland cultures as they are reproduced in the U.S. Because as I've shown here today, some immigrant families have more of this kind of communication than others. And this shapes how the children understand who they are. Right. It's a great question. I mean, I do think that language is an important barrier, because if you don't have the language, you can't communicate. But I think also that language is joined by other important factors that we need to be looking at. So one of that could be how, you know, Chinese immigrant parents could think about the homeland in different ways than Dominican immigrant parents do. So maybe they don't want to talk about the homeland too much for whatever reason. I mean, we'd have to know a little bit more about why. And then I think also the other reason is the fact that the Dominican Republic is so much closer to the United States. It's cheaper to go there. If you're going to go back for a family trip with your parents don't have to take 2 weeks to a month, right? I mean, off from work. I mean, these are folks who are working labor-intensive, working-class jobs. So it's hard to take time off, plus it costs them a lot of money, right? So that's another factor that we have to think about. And also maybe just the ways in which working-class Chinese immigrants may think about child-rearing and the relationship between parents and children as compared to Dominican working-class immigrant parents, right? That maybe they don't really feel the need to have this kind of emotional closeness to their children. I'm just speculating, right? Okay? I'm very close to it. But anyway, so something different might be going on there too. I mean, that's why it's important to have further research.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have, theory for
that. Sure.
I think you were talking about the transnational class positions of those immigrants.
Yes.
Compared to their homelands. And I find it very interesting, provides great insights too. Because I think in China is experienced a great economic booming in the past decades.
And yes.
Actually, when the working class immigrants go back to their homeland, they're probably receiving, I wouldn't say that they are actually maybe lower achiever compared to those who
stayed
in China. Because there is a gap in between them, and then that could lead to them have a different image. Like, why would I leave China? Like, if I can make such fortune just like my peer who probably works less than I do. And then that creates their own images about China, and then their own experience and how they want to communicate that fact to their children.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether I need some empirical. Is anyone talks about that?
No, that's another great point that you raise. I mean, I don't personally know of a lot of research in this area. I think it's definitely deserving of research for the reasons that you just talked about, right? I mean, you know, Asia and mainland China in particular has, you know, has become an economic, I mean, they've become economic powerhouses. If you think about the 1980s and early 1990s, this is before China became an, you know, huge powerhouse. You had the tiger economies, right, in Asia. That was kind of the big thing. And now you have China that is just, you know, leading on the global, you know, forefront. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, in a, you know, they might go back to visit relatives and friends in China, and they might think, why did I ever migrate in the first place? You know, migration, I mean, if you guys don't know this, migration's really hard. It's hard. It's a big decision to leave the country where you were born and raised and educated, where your family is, where your home language is, your home culture. It is really hard. And to come to another country and be displaced, right? I do know in some of the work that I've done with a different migration stream from China, meaning these are elites. These are folks who were highly educated in China, who came to study in top MBA programs in the U.S. In the middle 2000s of this decade. And even they were talking exactly what, and you know, these are folks who are kind of at the top of the, right? And so they're saying, you know, I got to really get through this program, even though it's only 2 years, because, you know, opportunity costs. And I would ask them, well, what do you mean? And I said, and they said, well, you know, I have friends and family who didn't come abroad, right? And, but it's so, there's so many opportunities in China now that they're doing better than I am. So. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hi. Thank you for the talk. Actually, it's very related to my own research interest. I kind of did some research on second generation contemporary Chinese and Dominican using the 2G in metropolitan New York.
Phil's data set and John, right? Yeah.
So I
great data set.
Literature shows that Chinese do kind of appears to be outliers because of upward assimilation and, you know, kind of better performance in education.
Yes, and absolutely.
Education. So we're searching for the interpretation or explanation for that kind of stuff. Usually people will attribute it to ethnic, like, ties because they say in Chinese communities there it's heterogeneous, so you kind of can get resources from, like, higher people with better resources, but within your ethnic communities. And I read through some of the interviews. I guess probably you can.
I could, yeah, I worked for the project. I'll tell you about it in a minute. Yeah, it's a great project, yeah.
Read through these interviews, I don't find that people will ever mention that, like, I get some help from someone better than. All they mention is like, oh, my parents just want me to go to college, so I just perform well. But when you're looking at, like, Dominicans, they kind of, oh, they just want me to be happy.
So right, so different meaning attached to, yeah, uh-huh.
So I kind of attributed the difference to culture difference, but it also confused me because things, they don't really retain their kind of culture or
right,
language,
right.
So I want to hear
my thoughts, yeah. Right, another great question. So the project that can you hear? I think my hair got in the way of the mic. But so the project that you're, what's your name?
Suchi.
Yeah. That Suchi is referencing is the Metropolitan Immigrant Second Generation in New York City study, which was based at the CUNY Graduate Center. And the principal investigators are Professors John Mollenkopf, Director of the Center of Urban Research at the CUNY Graduate Center, Philip Kazanitz, who's the Associate Director of that center, Mary Waters, who is in the Department of Sociology at Harvard, and Jennifer Haldaway, who is at the Social Science Research Council but is a CUNY alum. And I worked for the project when I was a doctoral student years ago, a long time ago, interviewing second-generation Chinese and native-born whites. So the project is great because it is a large-scale study of three native-born groups in New York City, native-born whites, native-born blacks, so African-Americans, and native-born Latinos, Puerto Ricans, because of the Commonwealth status of Puerto Rico. And then they also had five second-generation immigrant groups, Dominicans, a South American group that were Colombians, Ecuadorians, and Peruvians, the Chinese, West Indians, and Russian Jews. Did I get it right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Also, they kind of oversample Chinese because they want to yes. include like mainland China, Taiwan.
And Hong Kong. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. It's a great study. They did a large-scale survey, a phone survey, and then they did interviews with subsamples of folks in each group. And so basically, you're right. What they found in the book that they wrote from this data set, and the book is called Inheriting the City. It's a great book. What they found in that study was that the second generation Chinese were what they would call outliers, that even folks who came from working class families, the second generation Chinese would do better in school, get more education, and whatnot. And this kind of exceptionalism on the part of the Chinese has also been found in another great study, the Longitudinal Immigrant Student Adaptation Study, led by professors Marcelo Suarez-Rasco and Carola Suarez-Rasco, who are both now at UCLA. And that was a bicoastal study based in the San Francisco area, out on the West Coast, and in Boston, so the East Coast, looking at Central Americans, Dominicans, Haitians, the Chinese, one other group that I'm blanking on.
Mexicans,
that's right. Thank you. Thank you. And so, of course, and another great study, and they also found in their book, Learning a New Land, which is another great book, that the Chinese were kind of exceptional in the sense that they tended to be a large proportion of the high achievers in that study. Based on the work that they've done and also the work that I've done in my two books, I do think that access to resources in the ethnic communities is a large factor. They might not talk about it in the Chinese case because you remember you're interviewing second generation folk, right? So what they might say is, oh, how did you find out about Stuyvesant, right? The elite public high school, the test school in New York City. And they would say, correct me if I'm wrong, well, you know, my parents. Okay, well, so then if the interviewer probes, I was one of those interviewers, and as the interviewer should probe, well, how did the parents find out about Stuyvesant? And then they would say, well, you know, at work, in the garment factory, or in the Chinese restaurant where my parents work. And so, or in the media, the Chinese media, the ethnic language newspapers, there are so many, in the greater New York City area, very rich, outlets. And so they would find out through those stories that are written in the Chinese language newspapers about Stuyvesant or Bronx Science or Brooklyn Tech, about what the SAT is, right? About Harvard and that type of thing. And in the case of the Dominicans and in the Colombians, whom I studied for my second book, you don't have that, okay? You don't have that because, again, the wealth is really important. If to have a very strong ethnic media that would have that kind of knowledge to then talk about it in the media, you have to have people typically who have some money, right? Because usually it's people who have money that would know about these things and then share that information. What the Dominicans had, I found, was if they had kinfolk or friends in the U.S. who were middle class, what they would tell their parents was, send your kids to the Catholic schools. And because there's a rich tradition of that also in the DR, and generally speaking in Latin America and the Caribbean. Catholic schools cost money though. Okay? And, it especially costs a lot of money when you make the transition to high school. Okay? It's a little cheaper at the lower levels. And if they, what they said was that if their parents couldn't afford to send them to Catholic school, then the only alternative was the local neighborhood public school. But because Dominicans are racialized in different ways, they tend to be darker skinned in the United States, relatively speaking. So they live in neighborhoods near or with working class and poor Puerto Ricans and African Americans. And what we know about segregation in the United States along those kinds of racial lines is what that means is that they're going to get access to lower quality public schools. So I think that's an important thing to be thinking about. I do think, however, and I've talked to Phil a lot about this, Phil Kasinets, that it's important to look at, to investigate these kinds of cross-class ties in different immigrant communities to get a sense of what's happening and why people of different social classes in one group would even interact with one another. Because we know in the Dominican case, and they did talk about that in their book, in the Colombian case, that Colombians, both middle class and working class, are coming to the U.S., but they don't hook up, right? They don't care to know one another in the U.S. So what happens is you don't have that kind of key pipeline of information. And that's because there's a lot of mistrust due to what's happening in Colombia, with a lot of warfare and the drug trade and whatnot. And so they don't want to deal with other people of a different social class in the United States. The young man who was behind her?
Well, I'm just curious. In your sample of the interviewees, was there any Fujian or Fujianese involved? Because this is, the open question now.
Yeah, no, definitely. A few, some, definitely. I interviewed the Chinese back in 98 to 99, so that was kind of a while ago. And they had to have transitioned to college, so they're a little older. But definitely folks like Ken Guest and Zhe Liang, who are featured in the CUNY Forum, I'm pubbing it, Russell, do great work on the Fujianese immigration to the U.S. in the New York City context. And, of course, Peter Kwong was a pioneer in that field. So I'm kind of riffing off your question. The Fujianese, some proportions of the Fujianese can be undocumented. And that, of course, is going to have an influence on the extent to which immigrant parents, the kinds of jobs they can get, how they feel about life in the United States, and that's going to affect the home life and the kids. Hiro Yoshigawa, who is at NYU Steinhardt School of Education, also has done a book, Immigrants Raising Citizens, it's comparative, looking at Dominicans, the Chinese, and Mexicans in a study based at NYU, but looking at undocumented immigrants raising their U.S.-born citizen children in the New York City area. And looking at the influence, how documentation status, not having it, can really cause stress, anxiety for the immigrant parents who then, and that influences how the parents are able to raise their kids and get resources for their kids, and not in good ways. Mm-hmm. Russell.
I just want to say that the article in the CUNY Forum by they actually talk about it's not only parents but the Fujianese students themselves that
yes.
have developed their own studying strategies and ways in order to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
They may know that they are weaker in some subjects than the other, so they might study with other friends, and also things like, you know, even the cell phone and computer technology has made it easier to share things.
Right, for you younger folk, yeah.
That's a good way of helping each other to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other thing I was going to mention, if you go to any, whether it's a Chinatown in Queens or wherever Asians live, if you actually go into the Chinese bookstores, you know, half of the books at least are how to do book. They're either translations of, how to be successful in different things or very specific books on how to take SAT, GRE, or
yep.
advanced placement classes. And so it's very geared, a lot of these bookstores are really geared toward education for mm-hmm. students. And so parents can buy them. I buy them to teach some of my friends, help them with their English. I'm constantly surprised. And even, mm-hmm. They have so many books on how to function and get ahead in an American environment.
Yeah.
With technology, they even have not only the written, but sound. They have little computer things, the sound, and so you can hear, know how to pronounce things. But it's really amazing. There's so much stress in the bookstores, translations of success books or very specific strategies on learning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm not sure whether it's the same in other,
I mean, and that's another great thing to investigate. I think you and I have talked about it, or we should talk about it if I haven't remembered to talk about it with you. But comparing the ethnic media in different immigrant communities, but exactly also what you just said, Russell, going to see different immigrant communities, looking at bookstores or what they have available and who goes to the bookstores. I mean, I'm a sociologist by training, so that's kind of the legwork that I do, right? And folks like me. Mm-hmm. But, and folks like you, if you want to do that kind of research, which I highly encourage. Yes.
If you want to do a second edition of your first book, what changes do you have to make? Because the initial conditions have changed so much,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you talked about Chinatown before. And now is the mainland migration.
Right.
So the initial conditions changed so rapidly.
Hey, you're right. The book was published in...
That doesn't mean I
know. The book, so Compelled to Excel, which was on the children of Chinese immigrants, was published in 2004 based on data collected in 1998 to 1999. So Dad's absolutely right. It's been a while. And so I guess I would write a preface if there was a second edition published, much, very much along the lines that the young man in the back and that Russell have talked about having to examine the new Fujianese immigrant population, right, and what that means. That's one way in. The other way in is also to talk about how the second generation folks whom I interviewed in that study 15 years ago, right? It's kind of crazy. They're now 15 years older. So where are they now, right? This is the study actually that Margaret Chin, a colleague of mine at Hunter College in Sociology, is doing, looking at second generation Asian Americans, and how their fortunes have been affected, in some cases negatively affected, by the economic downturn that started in 2008, but in which we are still living, right? So these are folks who have a lot of education, have gotten professional jobs, but may have gotten laid off, in the recession. So that's another thing I would also talk about in the preface to this not yet existent second edition. But basically what I would say in answer to your question is that we need to do a lot of new research to explore those questions in today's era.
So also,
yes?
Let's say you would... compared to the Dominicans,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
You say that they are so much in common, being born in America,
yep.
And from there,
mm-hmm.
right, because of the language and so on and so forth. Now with the internet, correct?
Yes.
That the assumption that the initial condition that you made, right, that they, like the Chinese parents came from another planet, over here, because you don't know anything.
Exactly,
right?
Yes, this is true.
So now, because of internet, you could see the news.
Yes,
every day.
All right, yeah.
Even anything happens, right, any locality in China or Hong Kong or and so on, right? So that will have to...
You're absolutely realize. Right. Yes, absolutely. The role of technology, which has exploded... you know, in what, the last 15 years, the Dominican and Colombian data I collected between 2002 and 2006. So more recent, but still, even in that time span, technology, right, has exploded. So what does that mean for the ability, you're absolutely right, of the second generation to keep these transnational ties or to have them in the first place? That's another rich study that should be done, for sure, because now, you're right, the second generation might not need their immigrant parents so much to help them understand what life is like back there, because technology will help them do it themselves. Just the young man in the back, I just one question for each, and then we'll go to them. Yep. Mm-hmm.
I think besides the real second generation, which needs is somehow different, there may be a third group. It's kind of recent phenomenon, but I've encountered a student like that. It's hard to identify or categorize them as second generation, but they are not first generation either.
Yes.
Kind of this kind of case, okay. So some of their parents is from all over China, maybe from Guangdong, from many of them even from Northeast. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So they come here at 20 or 21, before the age that you can be migrate into the U.S. as a child of as a the child of parent, right? As a legal and visa or legal residence in the U.S. So they come here at 20 or 21. They already started their college in China. When they come here, they have to do the college all over again.
Right.
And oftentimes, they may come to a very good school, but I have nearly all my students, because I teach in Nagoya and CDF.
Mm-hmm.
All my students are this kind of group. They are not from Fujianese. They are not had the education here.
Yes.
They just come here, they have to do everything. Like, they may be very old. Some of them are 25 or 26, they are still doing their college. Another thing, maybe the other majors.
Right.
But this kind of group is different.
Oh, absolutely.
I believe that the number is not small. Because
right.
A lot of people in Flushing and in Sunset Park,
yes.
Those people, they are working, they are real first generation. They work maybe in the U.S. for 15 years. Somehow, maybe through political asylum or through courts, through all those kind of means, they
right.
become legal, have the green card.
Yes.
And they manage to make their children come to the U.S.
Yes.
But their children is different from the first, second generation you mentioned,
right.
different from the real undocumented Vietnamese people.
Yes, no, I mean, you raise several important points. I mean, one of them being age of arrival. So if you, the age at which you arrive in the new country here in the United States, for example. Mm-hmm.
They are not really first generation because they don't come here for work. They come here as a dependent. They rely on their family support them to go to college. They have to do the college over.
Okay. So that's another great point. Right. And age of arrival is very important because the older you are, and we know this from the work of developmental psychologists, the older you are, the harder it is, on average, to learn another language. So that's why the older you are, you know, but you have these expectations from your parents to do well in school, right? That's why you come to the United States in a way. Because America is famous for being the country of second, third, fourth chances at education. So even though they are older, right, they can go to college with the hope of, getting a degree and that helping them, to get a well-paying job. But the thing is that colleges are typically not set up to have students who are coming in at those older ages, nor are high schools, public high schools, set up to have immigrant children coming as teenagers. Really, what we have in the United States are public elementary schools and public middle schools. They're well set up to take in foreign-born children to help them learn English. Even though there are debates and issues about that as well. But that's where the resources lie. Although there are community-based organizations in lots of different immigrant communities that help folks who come at later ages with going into college or learning English or vocational education. Not enough resources that we could have, but there are some. I mean, we could be doing a much better job, but for that...
Consider that those people who come here after 12, you don't categorize them as second generation.
So I would categorize second generation as being the classic second generation are the U.S.-born children of parents who came as adults to the United States, 18 or older. The 1.5 generation are folks who came over by the age of 12. That's the cutoff point I use. Other people use a more fine finer gradation and would say that folks who come at the age of, 15 or 16 are the 1.25 generation, right? Because it's closer to the first. This is what we do in my business. but it's important. It is important. So don't worry. We have answers to your questions. So, some answers, anyway. Okay. Yes. Other questions on
so
this?
If the parents came on the 12th, what do you classify them as?
If they came under the age of children, they're 1.5ers. And if they have U.S.-born kids, then their kids are 2.5ers. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, right. I had to learn it myself. So, So, yes.
Can I ask?
Oh, okay, yeah.
I mean, that's a wonderful point. I think I'm one of the students coming down.
That age bracket? Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I don't think it's a problem. I don't see them as a disadvantage group. I saw them like advantage groups because a lot of them have plenty of resources back home. And the parents support them. And they form their own community groups. And they also got support from Chinese government, which the Chinese government actually said I would see them more like international students. And then the question that I have actually is for you is that when you compare students going to Columbia and Hunter College,
yes,
one is a city college, one is like Ivy League school,
yes,
like how they experience differences at different kind of like setting, because I consider they position themselves higher at Columbia University because it's an Ivy League school, but when they go to like Hunter College, how they think about those kind of like differences.
Sure, so you should read my book. No, I'm just joking. So that's a great question in the sense of you're absolutely right, and that's why I chose to sample at those two colleges because I wanted to look at what Peter Kwong has called, right, the downtown and the uptown Chinese, because class is a key pivot of difference and maps onto language, the Chinese language that you speak amongst the immigrant population in the United States post-1965. So just to give you a short answer to your question, the students whom I interviewed at Hunter, even though they were going to Hunter, which is, of course, one of the jewels in the CUNY system, they felt very differently. They felt that they had failed in just only ending up at Hunter, right? I mean, they felt this pressure from their parents, the model minority image, the friends, their parents' friends who had kids who had gone to these elite universities like Columbia. They felt this pressure that they should be going to Columbia, and they hadn't, right? And so, of course, the key question is how they made sense of that. I won't answer that part, but some of them did, some of them, of the working class folks did go to Columbia, but they tended to be children of parents, who had a bit of a higher status in the ethnic communities, like in the Chinatowns. So a noodle shop owner rather than a waiter in a noodle shop. I mean, these are kind of fine distinctions, but they do matter. And they felt, of course, pretty good about themselves that they had gotten to Columbia. Now, most of the folks whom I interviewed at Columbia, though, were the uptown Chinese. So these were the children of immigrants who had come to the United States from Asia with a lot of education, a lot of money, And they lived in the suburbs. And so predominantly back then, white middle-class suburbs. So when they go to Columbia, I mean, they feel this is where, of course, they should be. And when they talk about being, having an Asian American identity, they're really talking about being Asian American, having grown up in predominantly white middle-class suburbs. So it's a different kind of ethnic identity.
I mean, to clarify, can we characterize this understanding or the meaning-making that the second-generation Chinese that you studied, that they are actually ceasing to be transnationals, that they lose transnational subjectivity because they are no longer connected with either the transnational market or transnational culture?
I would say that. I would say that for this point of time at which I captured their experiences. And the reason that I say that is because the work that Peggy Levitt has done and other folks like Rob Smith, what they've shown us is that, you know, we, as human beings, we have a life course, right? So life is, you know, evolves over time. So one thing to be thinking about is maybe as they get older, right, they would have more transnational attachments or a transnational subjectivity. It's unclear. At the point of time in which I captured their experiences, they were not. But that might change or it might not. I mean, as they get older. I mean, that's why it's important to look at the life course, too, in research.